Committee on Environment and Natural Resources will come to order. Quorum is not yet present, but we are going to start by bringing back Senate File 2185, Senator Olsen.
Off the table. You have to bring it off the table.
Chair members, thank you. I'm here on.
You could do that on your own.
It was just laid over, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah, but just take it from the table.
All right. Well, I'm informed that I need to formally state that Senate File 2185 is removed from the table. Welcome back.
It's nice to be back, Mr. Chair. I left with an assignment to find out about how much water is pulled out of the Mount Simon-Hinckley. DNR states that they don't know that number, but they have provided materials that show the number of monitoring wells, and I believe you have that in your packet, that shows how they monitor the aquifer and the number of wells and their depths. So they watch the aquifer. So I do have the A2 amendment, which is language that we've worked out with DNR and all parties that address domestic water.
There's a new amendment coming for this.
Still coming.
Mr. Chair, Knopf. Senator Olsen, I think there's a new amendment coming. When I looked at the previous one, it wasn't completely clear. I think Carlin's downstairs getting a new one ready. It should be here momentarily, I think.
Why don't you go ahead and start describing it?
Okay, so we changed the definition of potable water to domestic, and then a description of domestic water, which is domestic water uses include water used for general household purposes for essential human needs such as cooking, cleaning, drinking, washing, and waste disposal. And so then the other new language is about the 100 million gallons per year. If that's the cap, unless there is no feasible or practical alternative to that source, and that then there would have to be a water conservation plan in place if they were seeking a permit to use more than the 100 million gallons a year. That's the essence of the bill, Mr. Chair.
What did we find out on the 100 million gallon threshold? Because the testimony from the DNR was that as I recall, it sounded like a good number was their statement. So someone want to speak to that? Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself.
Mr. Chair, Jim Japs, Assistant Director, DNR Division of Waters. There's a handout that everybody should have that has a little bit of background information on this. And what we found was on the bottom of the first page there, it's got water use data, and it breaks it down by the number of permits within a certain category. So we have 57 permits out of 264 total permits that reported more than 100 million gallons in 2008. There were 9 permits that reported between 75 and 100 million gallons, and then there were 11 permits that reported between 50 and 75 million in 2008. The rest of the permits, 189 of those, reported less than 50 million gallons in 2008. On the back of that sheet, there's also hydrograph that shows water use from 1988 to 2008 for both the statewide Mount Simon-Hinckley water use and also the 7-county metro Mount Simon aquifer water use. Statewide, we're just around that 27 billion gallons per year range, and in the metro area, we're down around the just under 14 billion gallons per year. One of the questions that came up last time also related to what does 100 million gallons a year look like. And so at the bottom of the hydrographs there, I just put together some information. If you assume that there's a person uses 75 gallons of water per day, that would supply 3,653 people, approximately 1,500 homes. And just to give you a sense for what it might look like on Lake Harriet, it would be just less than a foot of water over the surface of Lake Harriet, which is 335 acres, and 100 million gallons is about 308 acre feet of water. So just less than a foot.
So Senator Olsen or whoever, what is the upshot of this bill? What are you trying to do? You're trying to limit high usage of drinking water. Is that correct? or you're trying to allow for more?
Mr. Chair, we're trying to put a limit on high usage out of the Mount Simon aquifer.
Okay. So you're saying if a project, would be prohibited from using more than 100 million gallons?
That is correct.
New projects?
That is also correct. And we do, Mr. Chair, we do have provisions in there that if that's not feasible or practical, that there is a way to draw more, but it would require a water conservation plan with the permit. So, okay. But I think our goal, Mr. Chair, is that this aquifer is very it's a large aquifer, but it takes water possibly 1,000 years for some of that water to get down there, and I think we really need to think seriously about pulling it out of there, especially on a pass-through basis for cooling or that kind of use.
Okay. Senator Ingebrigtsen?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olsen, to get it clear in my mind, so if a business comes into that area and they're projecting to use more than 100 million, they have to get a special permit or they won't get a permit?
Mr. Chair, they would need a permit for that kind of drawing that kind of water anyhow, but if to go over the 100 million, then they would need to demonstrate that there was no practical alternative to get water, like from a reservoir or something, some other alternative source of water. And then they would have to develop a conservation plan.
So reuse.
That, yeah. To basically, reuse. Yes. I'll let Mr. Japs address that further.
Sure. Mr. Japs.
Within the metro area, it would be limited to domestic uses only. Outside the metro area, there would be some allowances for non-domestic commercial industrial uses up to 100 million gallons per year. And that's after they do a needs assessment or an alternative evaluation on all other water sources and also include conservation provisions as part of the permit.
So you want to make sure there's a good reason to use drinking water for industrial purposes?
Correct.
That's the ultimate aim of the bill.
Right.
Okay. We're waiting for the amendment.
Yeah.
Ready to pass it.
We haven't formed yet.
Oh, great.
I have to call up my wife. I should put Molly on another map. Put it on the phone. All day.
An informed quorum is now present.
Don't worry, I love it.
Let's need our amendments.
Is there an amendment?
Because I'll tell you, I'm going to be pegged with
it. We're now on the 8th. I had to make a couple of changes so that it would work. Just saying.
Okay. Good work.
Thank you.
You know, we did, but this is a delete everything. So the later amendment doesn't really have what was adopted before.
Okay, Senator Olsen walked us through the contents of this amendment. It's a delete everything, so it will become the bill, so we can still contemplate the language. But let's vote on the A3. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to move the bill.
Okay. Further discussion? Seeing none. Senator Anderson moves that Senate File 2185, as amended, be recommended to pass and re-referred anywhere. Be recommended to pass. We'll go to the floor. Any discussion on the motion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your work on this, Senator Olsen.
Well.
Senator Saxhog.
Oh,
Senate File 2760.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I have a subcommittee report I'd like to move.
On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Today I'm presenting Senate File 2760. This is the annual DNR forestry bill. And first I'd like to thank my subcommittee who worked diligently on here, Senator Sharon, Senator Ingebrigtsen, and Senator Dibble, who was my chair for that meeting. That was great. Did good work. And with me today is Bob Tomlinson from the DNR Division of Forestry, and he's going to speak a little bit to the bill and answer any questions that the committee might have.
Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Bob Tomlinson, the Assistant Director with the DNR Division of Forestry. I'll just quickly walk through the sections of the bill and stand for any questions. But Section 1 of the bill deals with general burning permits. What we've had to do in the last few years is withdraw forestry folks from the southwestern part of the state and focus more of our forestry efforts up in the forested parts of the state. And as a result of that, we need a new way of doing business relative to burned permits in that part of the state, agricultural counties. There's about 20 to 25 counties that will be potentially affected by this. Basically, it would allow for the establishment of an alternative to the requirement for written burning permits in those agriculture counties. And those are defined as any counties that have less than 1,000 acres of contiguous forest land throughout the state. So currently we have an electronic burn permit system. As most of you are aware, we had quite a number of discussions about that a few years back over here with that. And we have the written burning permits that we issue via the township fire wardens and others. This would be a third option for those counties that opt in for it. We will work with them to come up with a blanket.
Hold on 1 second. Can you give the witness our attention, please? Thank you.
We will work with those counties then that opt to go along with this, and if they don't, they can stick with the electronic and the current written burn permit approach that they've been using. Section 2 of the bill deals with permanent tree brush open burning sites, and it just adds provisions for site dimensions, burn pile size, operating conditions, and smoke management on permanent tree and brush open burning sites. Section 3 of the bill relates to the fees that we charge to private landowners. We've begun charging now for stewardship plan preparation. As of December 1, we began that. And the commissioner's office felt that to be make sure that we're very transparent about what we're charging and for what fees, that we need to have those published by written order in the state register. That's essentially directs us to do that as we make changes to those fees or add additional ones. Section 4 of the bill deals with timber sales. The first one is the reoffering of unsold tracts of timber at public auction. We want to be able to reoffer sales that don't sell at the appraised value at below that appraised value for the purposes of regenerating the stands and getting them back in a healthy and productive state. We probably will not do that in all places. I can guarantee you we won't do it in all places, but there are certain selected stands that just aren't going to sell at the appraised value, so we'd reoffer it at that lower level. The Section 5 of the bill deals with intermediate sales. Currently, we have intermediate sales that are up to 3,000 cords, and then anything over 3,000 cords is considered a regular auction sale. Intermediate sales are restricted to being sold to only those companies with 20 or fewer employees. It's come up every once in a while it comes up that how do we determine when a company has 20 employees or not? We're kind of questioned on that. And so what this section of the bill does, it makes it clear that we will use Department of Labor and Industry workers' comp records. I should mention that we are still talking with Department of Labor and Industry as to whether or not they're the exact entity that we go to for that or not, but everybody seems to agree that the workers' comp records are the standard by which we would use to evaluate that in the future. So that's Section 5 of the bill. Mm-hmm. Section 6 of the bill deals with auction sale procedures. We're looking for down payments on state timber via the when we're selling them via sealed bid, that they must be received or postmarked within 14 days of the date of the sealed bid opening. This makes it much more date certain for us, and so it's pretty should be very crystal clear, if you will, to both our folks selling the timber and to the purchasers when the bid guarantee needs to be into us. And then the second part of that is that the bid guarantee would only apply when sales are bid up more than $5,000, $5,000 or greater. Anything less than that, we wouldn't require to go through the bid guarantee, the additional bid guarantee work. And then Section 7 of the bill deals with the repealers. We feel that we don't need to continue to provide an annual timber sale report, that we've got that information on a regular basis because of the investments that we've made in information technology in the division and in the department. We can provide it real time, anytime, all the types of information that you're looking for. And so that's our preferred way to go with that. So that is the various sections of the bill.
Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, and either Senator Saxhauer or Mr. Tomlinson, I'm interested in the general burning permit that can be issued by a county board of commissioners. And I'm wondering if under that general permit, under the paragraph D where it says, upon adoption of a general burning permit, the county must establish specific regulations by ordinance. Can that ordinance also require that individuals obtain a burning permit from the county?
Mr. Tomlinson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fredrickson, yes, it might, but then again, it might not. The idea being that it's up to each county to develop their permit system, to how they would like to approach it. I know that it was brought up in the House side that that perhaps anybody burning ought to be notifying somebody on the day of the burn, as an example. And some counties would like to have that done, and that's we're okay, we're good with that. That's okay. But on the other hand, if they don't want to have that done, we're okay with that as well. Keep in mind that all the other restrictions around burning would still apply. It's just the way in which this blanket permit, if you will, would be issued down there.
Mr. Tomlinson, I'm familiar with burning in southwest Minnesota, which this refers to. In the 1970s, when we had a lot of Dutch elm disease, I burned some rather large piles of Dutch elm disease trees. And I know I had to get a permit, and there are some things I had to follow, like notify the local fire department, had to make sure that there weren't old tires and things like that, and there was a checklist. And I would not want to see us go away from that. Because the local, we don't want the local fire department called out because a neighbor reports a fire on a neighboring farm when they're burning an old brush pile.
Mr. Tomlinson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Fredrickson, first off, if it was illegal to burn tires then, it's still illegal to burn tires now and that sort of thing. I think the only part that we're talking about potentially here that might be different would be the notification, that if the county feels that in their particular case, burning can take place without being notified on a daily basis, then we'll work with them to help them with that system. But there would still be other things that they might want to put in place. For example, that burning has to take place between 6 in the evening and 6 in the morning, and that you can't be burning the hazardous materials like coven, those sorts of things like that as well.
Senator Anderson. Well,
Mr. Chair, on the same section, what I don't understand is what is allowed. They like my question, I guess. What is allowed and isn't allowed to be burned by under existing state law? Is it this is just about vegetation and brush and trees, or is this about, would this allow open permits, countywide permits for burning garbage?
Mr. Tomlinson.
Mr. Chair, I believe 88, Chapter 88, Senator Anderson, deals only with vegetation and trees and that sort of thing. So, no, the other things, we're not into that part of the business, of the burning
okay.
business. So.
And, Mr. Chair, any have there been issues with, and maybe Senator Fredrickson would know from your experience, have there been any issues where there's a lot of burning going on, where people are concerned about smoke and particulates and, you know, making it hard to, you know, wafting air pollution floating from county to county? I mean, I know you're out on the countryside, so that's generally not going to be an issue, but...
Usually it's not an issue, but it may be, depending upon where the fire is located and the prevailing wind. You know, one of the conditions of permit might be, I would assume, that they could not burn if, say, example, it was a southwest wind, and the southwest wind put the smoke plume into Senator Vickerman's farmstead.
Or, Mr. Chair, or it might put it right in the middle of a town.
No.
And so those restrictions would be left up to county-by-county decision? Or would there be any limitations?
Mr. Tomlinson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, again, that's why we will probably recommend to the county, of course, it would be by mutual agreement with them, but we would recommend that they restrict burning to the evening hours when the wind, after the wind has died down, those sorts of things. That's kind of currently the way it is right now. I think the issues around smoke management have primarily been, because it longer lasting, around the burn pile situation, which is dealt with in Section 2 of the bill, in which actually what we're trying to do there is make it very clear to folks that we want to address smoke management issues, and we want to have a clear understanding that we will close operations if there is smoke problems that are longer standing, those sorts of things. So,
can I ask a general question not related to the bill? Does our Sustainable Forestry Act apply to all logging operations, or only on certain lands, state lands? Mr. Tomlinson?
Mr. Chair, members, the Sustainable Forestry Act applies across the board to all lands, but keep in mind that the guidelines that are specified in the Sustainable Forestry Act are voluntarily complied with.
See.
We do monitoring to assure that the guidelines are being followed. And we've made it real very clear that as it relates to state forest lands, you will follow them. Everybody follows them. They're written right into the timber contracts and those sorts of things. But we don't force that upon, you know, the private landowners, the industrial owners, and the county landowners and that sort of thing.
Right.
So, but by and large, okay. Monitoring has found that they are largely followed.
The reason I asked is that I was snowmobiling this winter, and we passed a fresh clear cut. It seemed to be very, very large.
Okay.
Now, I understand and accept that, you know, clear cuts serve a purpose environmentally, that there is a place for them. But this one seemed particularly large, and particularly where seemed to be a previously planted stand, and that it could have been culled as opposed to just clear cut. But I don't think it was on state land. So it just made me wonder how our laws apply. I am not suggesting anything was being done illegal, but that question popped up in my mind. Okay. Further questions, Senator Anderson?
Mr. Chair, I'm looking at Section 4 on the reoffering of the timber sales, and Mr. Mueller points out there is a fiscal note on this, and so it does need to go to finance, but maybe we should just ask Mr. Tomlinson just to address that. Do you expect it to bring in more revenue or to cost? What does it look like?
There goes it up here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, the fiscal note is, well, there's a positive fiscal impact. One is because we're assuming, and that's all we can do at this point, is that if we were to reoffer 50% of the sales that didn't sell, and if 50% of those then sold for 50% of what we were asking, that sort of a thing, then we would bring revenue in that we wouldn't otherwise bring in. But the other thing is that we would also offset costs that we would have to incur in going out and paying somebody to remove that vegetation, that, you know, what it might be, whatever it might be, decadent trees, in order to get the site regenerated and back into a healthy state. So those two things in combination, the increased revenue and the less cost, provide for a positive outcome relative to fiscal end of it.
So this needs to go to finance. Senator Kielash?
Yeah, just to follow up on that, could you give me a little better description why certain areas do not sell? And is there any consideration that bidders would not bid on certain areas because they could get it at a fire sale and the reoffering?
Mr. Tomlinson.
Mr. Chair, members, certainly that last point is a possible one. However, you know, there's enough competition. I think in most cases we're talking about stands of trees that are decadent, that perhaps are breaking up, and that are in dire need, if you will, of regeneration treatment, which it would be best done via the harvest, and we'd like to move it that way. So I use the example, and there's places in the state, of course, where the markets, the demand for the wood isn't anything near what it was 2 or 3 years ago as well. So, but we want to be clear that we're not looking to reoffer healthy, vigorously growing younger stands that will wait for a better market to come around. We're talking about offering lesser, the decadent stands that are really in dire need of the regeneration treatment to get them to come back in a responsible way. I hope I'm trying to answer your question.
I think you got to just...
And Senator Kielash, an example might be that whereas paper companies are looking for popple that's maybe 50, 60 years old, if it gets to be 70 or 80, the value is going to go down, and they might be just good for biomass, and that's worth less. Okay. So,
Mr. Tomlinson?
I should mention, Mr. Chair, that right now the way we had set a minimum appraised price at the beginning is that we use the past 6 months of transactional evidence for that type of species of tree in that geographic area of the state. And so we set that. So, for example, we might set the price of the aspen at $20 or $25 a cord, and if it doesn't sell and if it's breaking up, that sort of thing, we want to have that option to go back and lower that appraised value down to $12 and then reoffer it via the auction again. But, again, it would only be for those stands where we really feel we need to do that regeneration treatment. And the other point to make, I think, too, is that it could be bid up in the auction on that second time around, too. So,
can I follow up just one? Are we talking about large stands or usually smaller stands in this kind of? I'm just trying to get a feel for how big a problem this is. And I realize I'm putting you on the spot, Steve. Why is it just? Is it large stands, small stands, or
does it tend to be across? Mr. Chair, members, I think it could be across the board.
Okay. Thank you.
One quick question. At our hearing in Bemidji, Senator Stumpf had a constituent who was quite vociferous in some of his objections relating to burning permits, and I don't really know exactly what it was about, but you know if it, your bill would go any way towards addressing those concerns, maybe Senator Stumpf could weigh in as well.
Well, Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf and others, I don't think our bill changes anything the way that we're currently issuing the written or the electronic burn permits. It's just adding that third option, a blanket permit down in the southwestern part of the state.
Okay. Senator Dibble?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I raised this in subcommittee. I know Senator Anderson might have raised it as well about burning, and I just want to just resurface my I don't know if it's a concern. I just want to reiterate that, if we think this is going to greatly increase the amount of burning down in the southwestern part of the state, that we just kind of pay attention to air pollution and particulate matter, you know, because that stuff drifts easterly, and we've had now, I think, 20 air pollution alert days that relate specifically to particulates in the metropolitan area, greatly affecting sensitive groups and people who are active outdoors, of which I am, and so I've had to not go on my daily run and do other things 20 different times this winter, which is disconcerting. So just so that we're paying attention to that issue when we're doing this kind of
sure.
anyone can burn any time provision in southwestern Minnesota. So just so that there's some conditions, we pay attention to air pressure, all that sort of thing. So,
Senator Stumpf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You know, I think every one of us burns every day. The minute you turn your ignition on in the car, and I don't foresee a huge increase in burning. It's kind of an interesting thing. Travel a lot. I put on, anywhere from 40 to 60,000 miles a year, maybe sometimes more. And there's very seldom do you actually see fires or smoke, except in the area of, there's an increase in home heating with wood, which is totally acceptable because that's not adding to any carbon going up into the air. I still don't understand that one. But where I see larger fires, it would be actually burning, like, say, the DNR burns off a wildlife area, some purpose of wildlife management. I don't, actually see any, our landfills don't burn, our... it's a kind of a seldom occurrence where you actually see some smoke and fire there.
Mr. Tomlinson.
Well, Mr. Chair, members, I don't think we're looking at any more or less burning occurring. I think what Senator Stumpf was saying too, with the changes that we're talking about in this bill, I think it's just a different way of issuing the permit. I think still we're going to need to work closely with each county on an individual basis to make sure that we're doing it carefully and that we're trying to manage those that smoke considerations that you have on certain days, those sorts of things like that. And we still do. When we get to red flag days, we'll put out burn restrictions, which will have to be followed by the counties regardless of where they're at, so whatever system they might have in place. So we want to still have the same high level of care and thoughtfulness that goes into burning now, I think, relative to it. And I don't see this changing much, that or the number of burns or anything happening with it. So
I think here it's more than
further discussion,
Mr. Chairman,
on the bill. Senator Fredrickson.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to go back to my concern on page 1 and page 2, and I've had a chance to reread that section. I'd like to move on page 2, line 3, after permits, insert under this subdivision. And that would mean they would not need to get the county board adopts the ordinance, they would not need to get a permit from the state. But it would still leave the option open for the county to require a burning permit if they wanted to do that under their ordinance.
Senator Saxog indicates his support. Want to understand the amendment? On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Further discussion on Senate File 2760. Seeing none, Senator Saxog moves that Senate File 2760 be recommended to pass.
Sent to finance?
Oh, and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Members, next we move to Senate File 3044. Senator Chaudhry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate File 3044 raises the resident fishing license from $17 to $21 in 2011, next year, and then another $4 in 2015. And it also raises the non-resident license fee by 50 cents. And it also uses the money raised for a couple of purposes, the first being to allow all kids under the age of 18 to fish for free, to devote some of the increased money to stocking, and to provide additional reimbursement to our licensing agents. The fishing license fee was last raised a decade ago. However, since that time, the Citizens Budget Oversight Committee for the Game and Fish Fund has recommended on two occasions to raise the fishing license fee. At this year's annual DNR roundtable, where all the stakeholders of game and fish issues have a two-day conference, it was a consensus position that the fishing license fee be raised. Why would we need to raise the fishing license fee? The number one reason is that the Game and Fish Fund will be out of balance, will be in the red by 2013. That was actually pre-February forecast prediction. At the moment, the game and, prior to the forecast, the Game and Fish Fund had a $5 million balance. However, the February forecast just recently released has indicated that the Game and Fish Fund actually has a $4 million balance, a 20% less than was thought. And so and the DNR can talk about their predictions on this. It's quite likely that the Game and Fish Fund will go into the red even before 2013. Another reason why we need to do this is what we have discussed often in this committee and in Senator Anderson's Finance Committee is the imbalance in the Game and Fish Fund between wildlife spending and fisheries spending. We're not seeking, I don't want to rehash the whole debate, but we're not seeking a hermetic seal between the two, but the trends over the last decade have shown a disproportionate increase on the spending on wildlife-related issues versus fisheries-related issues from the total fund. Furthermore, if we've seen over the last couple of biennia, we've been cutting funding in the Game and Fish Fund. If Senator Anderson had not passed out the bill that she had on budget cuts this last week, there would have been even more cuts to the Game and Fish Fund as proposed by the governor by transfers out of the Game and Fish Fund. However, the fact remains is that there have been cuts due to budget problems in the Game and Fish Fund in the fisheries area. Minocqua, a program that helps youth get into fishing, stocking, all of those have been reduced. The fourth thing I'd like to mention is that as we should be concerned about people's ability to pay, Minnesota is different from other states in that we have a conservation license that people can pay for which they can pay half price for a fishing license. So if $21 to fish the entire year actually is a hardship for some people, we have the option in Minnesota of a resident having the ability to pay half of that amount as a safety valve. Since the January DNR roundtable, I've asked quite a bit from anglers what they feel about a fishing license fee increase. And to my surprise, it has been near universal support. Even for a community that is often critical of spending by the Department of Natural Resources. There's near total support, in my view, for a fishing license fee increase from anglers. And this bill, as a result, comes from anglers. It is not my proposal. It is one that was asked for by the angling community. However, there have been some concerns that I've heard cited over a fishing license fee, but those have centered on knowing where the money goes. And so that's why I've incorporated into the bill some direction for how the money will be spent. Most important, in my opinion, allowing all kids to fish for free, not just those under 16. To devote money towards stocking programs, which has been a source of great conversation annually at the DNR roundtable. And actually, we learned that this past roundtable from the DNR that the walleye stamp will be the only source of funding for walleye, that it would not be additive to current sources, that will not be additive to current sources, but will replace them. And it addresses concerns that I've heard for many years that the license agents who sell fishing licenses and hunting licenses take a hit on their process and what they have to pay for to be able to sell licenses. And so this, and I don't believe that their reimbursement has been increased. That haven't been able to find a specific date, but I've heard over two decades that it's been $1 reimbursement out of the license for over two decades. I could be wrong, so maybe we'll hear different. So we need this bill, and anglers want this bill. If we want to keep our game and fish funding solvent, it's important for us to act this year. I don't think this can wait another year. It was a source of discussion whether we should have the increased supply this year, but I think the angling community wanted to give some lead time for it to come into effect in 2011 and then another bump in 2015. So with me, Mr. Chair, is representatives of Anglers for Habitat, Vern Wagner and Lance Ness.
Thank you, Senator Chaudhry. And gentlemen, I'd have you pull those microphones right up close to you. We have a lot of noise in here today, and we're going to start with a question from Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Chaudhry, could you refresh my memory as to who other than the DNR is authorized to issue licenses? Are deputy registrars able to do that, or is it in, you know, bait and hunting retail operations?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I believe that deputy registrars are authorized to. However, in a conversation with the deputy registrars, one conversation I had, they see very low volume at those license centers. It's mainly through the retail operations as well as online.
Thank you.
Mr. Ness and Mr. Wagner, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself as you begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Lance Ness. I'm the current president of Anglers for Habitat. I want to thank Senator Chaudhry for bringing forward this bill so we can have a discussion about fishing license increases. We support the bill. Roughly, we view fishing licenses as probably the best dollar for your bang you can get. For $20, you can fish all year. You can take your kids fishing. It's probably the cheapest form of relaxation and quality time you can have with your family. We also feel we want to make sure we head off any sort of deficit that the DNR has. So that's why we proposed a two-tier increase. Basically, it's almost a cost of living increase. In 2011, we hope for a $4 increase, and again in 2015. And basically, we want to help this imbalance that is occurring with the Fish and Wildlife Fund, where we're kind of commingling those funds, and it's an imbalance on the hunting community and not the fishing community. So we want to address that as well. And I'll let Mr. Wagner take over from here. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Ness. Mr. Wagner?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Vern Wagner. I'm Vice President of Anglers for Habitat. I've been a strong supporter of this. I brought it up at the DNR roundtable. I took the heat and answered most of the questions. Minnesota, in Minnesota, fishing is a $2.8 billion industry. Our DNR fisheries are the caretakers of this fishery. We're the third highest state in angler expenditures from fishing. We find that sport fishing in Minnesota involves 43,000 jobs and $1.3 billion in salaries and earnings. So this is the type of industry that we're interested in keeping running and having good caretakers for it. Right now, deer money is being used to supplement a $4 million deficit in fisheries. Our fisheries department is down 30 positions that have not been filled. So they're learning how to do more with less. What will happen with this increase? I'm not sure that it will bring those 30 jobs back, but it'll very likely prevent 30 more losses in the future as the budget rises. But recreational fishing is much more than just a getaway. It provides a living for a countless number of people in all areas of the state. And it's really what Minnesota is known for. Now, there's a couple of things that I believe very strongly about in this bill. One, primarily, is raising the threshold on who can fish for free. Having spent a lot of time studying this issue, I just finished Last Child in the Woods, Nature Deficiency, and we're always struggling with this issue. You know, getting that fishing license when you were age 16 used to be a rite of passage, and that was a really important thing in a young adult's life. Now I can have my own fishing license. Well, today's generations of young anglers are different. Getting their first Nintendo or Xbox is their rite of passage. So we're, and I wish I could change that. I wish I had a time machine and I could go back and change all of that. But I think we need to focus on what's true now. We need to bring young people into this sport. We need to allow for spontaneous participation. If you're up at someone's cabin and you want to go out fishing and you'd have to drive to town to buy a license, you're probably not going to do that. Okay, but then we thought, well, wait a minute. If we exempt these kids from fishing, from buying a fishing license, won't we lose money? Well, we're already losing that demographic, I'm sorry to say. If you crunch the numbers, and I can supply those with license sales, we're already seeing a decline in that age group. So what I'm hoping that we will do is we'll open the front door to this sport farther and bring people through it. Another point I'd like to make today is that when we look at surrounding states, Wisconsin is at $20. South Dakota is at $25 for their license. It's a little cheaper. You can go to North Dakota and fish for $10. Except I think they only have one lake. We're trying to be competitive. We haven't recommended raising the non-resident fee very high. The non-resident fee was raised a few years ago, and they are being surcharged $2 for invasive species work. So they'll probably be due for an increase in a few more years. But frankly, when I talk to the guides, when I talk to the resorts, when I talk to the people in outstate Minnesota who are in the fishing tackle business, they want those out-of-state anglers here. They want those dollars spent in their store. If we raise the non-resident fee to $50, would that really affect who comes to Minnesota? Would they change their plans, cancel their trips? Probably not, but would they buy a license? Or would they just decide to play golf while they're here? Or would they buy a license for their kids and their family members? You know, we have to be very careful when we raise this for non-residents. So you won't find much of that in there. One of the other things that we're doing is we're putting aside some money for stocking. You know, usually when you talk about stocking in Minnesota, you're talking about walleye stocking. But this isn't just for walleye stocking. It's for trout. It's for muskie. It's for any species that we feel that we need to move forward with. Now, if you look around here in the audience, and I'm sure some of these people will testify, we've got Trout Unlimited here, we've got muskies, we've got the Bow Fishing Association, we've got the Bass Federation. Who am I missing here? We got the Dark House Association. We have retired DNR. So if you have any fishing questions, we can also have those answered today. I think there are some other people who would like to testify, but I would be open to any questions you have at this point.
Well, thank you, Mr. Wagner, for that testimony. And just so you know, the Assistant Attorney General from North Dakota happens to be in this building today. So if you are going to make disparaging remarks about their fishing ability, you may want to be somewhat careful. Senator Sieben.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for your testimony, Mr. Wagner. I don't know who to – maybe this is for the author, but Senator Chaudhry, do you know what the current status is of our licensed dealers getting payment for credit card fees? Because I remember a couple years back there was a task force, and as you know, the problem is the credit card companies don't let the sellers or the retailers charge a fee for the credit card, so essentially the retailers are then paying for the credit card fee and losing, you know, and not recovering that money. So anyone else have any idea where that's
at? Mr. Chair, Senator Sieben, a couple of years ago, we passed a statute allowing them to recover that fee for credit cards.
So that anybody this else? Won't affect that then?
No.
Because if it goes up, then they can also increase their fee a fraction.
Correct.
To cover that cost?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Wagner or Mr. Ness? Senator Ingebretson.
Mr. Chair, to Senator Sieben's point, if I could, with
sure.
regards to licensing, and maybe Senator Chaudhry can answer this. There's been some talk about dropping resorts from issuing license fees for fishing. Where is that at? Is that anything to be of concern? Because I know that's a one-stop shop for those that come and don't want to drive all the way into town. They're able to issue the fees, and hopefully that's going to continue.
Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebretson, thanks for bringing that up. It's an issue that has a few complexities that the DNR will talk about a little later. I'm of the view that we ought to retain as many of these small licensed dealers as possible, but there are some practicalities with their system that the DNR is saying prevents them from allowing all people who have previously done it to continue doing it for the moment. However, they are working on an alternative method for them to continue to do it online. But they'll speak more to that.
Thank you. Other questions? Senator Anderson.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And I apologize. I had to step out for a moment to meet with some constituents. So I didn't hear if you brought this issue up, but I guess my question is, it's really for Senator Chaudhry or your witnesses. I support what you're doing with this bill, but I guess my concern is, can we do anything to help people who are really struggling economically? And, you know, I was at this event a couple weeks ago that was really, it was very cool. We were serving food at a food shelf and it was donated fish that had been caught at a fishing tournament. And it occurred to me, you know, somebody who's going to a food shelf to feed their family, maybe we could help them out with a free fishing license for the period of time that they're, or if they're out of work, you know. I have a carpenter who came and did some work in my house, and he said, you know, the bad news is I'm not working. The good news is I have time to hunt and fish. And I, you know, if people are trying to go fishing to feed their family, $21 is going to be a lot of money, perhaps. And I think it might, I don't know how many people would want to take advantage of something like that, but I wonder if you'd consider putting in some kind of provision during, you know, the times when some profession, some of the tradespeople out there have 25% unemployment right now in their areas. If we could give them a break, that would make it a little easier to raise the fee in times like this.
Senator Chaudhry, you touched on that, and maybe you could also touch on the process to achieve that half-price license.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I made two or three points regarding what you mentioned.
Of course I pay.
First of all, the ability to pay issue has not been lost on the angling community. It's something that we've always, it's actually been the first thing we've talked about. And I think the conclusion and the consensus is that this is not a new $21. It's four more dollars for an entire year of fishing. And the feeling is that that is not burdensome, particularly given the fact that this money goes towards managing the fisheries and the ability to fish in the first place. But secondly, unlike a lot of other states, Minnesota has a conservation license, which you can pay half price for, and you only have to take two-thirds of the limit. So it's still pretty good deal, and we do have that safety valve.
Senator Chaudhry,
the last item is that this doesn't go into effect until 2011. So it's still over a year out before this would go into effect.
Senator Chaudhry, I believe it's two-thirds on the cost and half on the limit.
And I thought it was the other way around.
I think you had a tip, but
did I have it wrong? Okay.
So what is the cost, Mr. Chair? I don't remember how much the conservation license.
The cost, I understand, would be two-thirds of the current.
So what's our fee? $10 okay. or something, yeah. $10 or $12.
And then you could take half the limit.
Mm-hmm. Stand corrected.
Thank you. Other questions for our witnesses? If not, Jim Lilienthal. We'll thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. And I don't know if we want to come up two at a time, Peter Perovich or. And also keep the mics fairly close to you so that we can hear today. Thank you very much. And welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself as you begin your testimony.
My name is Jim Lilienthal. I'm a member of the Anglers for Habitat group. And I also am a board member of the Minnesota Fishing Museum in Little Falls. I'll come on up and look at it. The reason I'm here today is to testify in favor of this this bill and to speak to any questions that you might have. What I didn't mention was I was also a 38-and-a-half-year area member of the DNR Fisheries. I was a area supervisor at Little Falls and participated in many of the rearing programs around the state and have quite a background in rearing walleye and muskie and also in working with different types of regulations with the fisheries program. Some of my concerns for the bill include the lack of money available for programs in fisheries. That has taken a huge hit, and I keep in contact with my former colleagues and talk to them about a lot of the things that are going on today. And we have a very talented group of fisheries experts out there that, frankly, could be doing more with less. By that I mean they could be doing. They are doing more with less already, excuse me. What we need is an efficient ability to add the programs that we see needing. There's so many things that have been added since I was a young fisheries supervisor, and that was That includes all the AIS, the aquatic invasive species problems that Minnesota is experiencing now and will experience more in the future. Dealing with those problems is a prime concern of many of the lake groups, including the wet place that I live on, Lake Alexander in Morrison County. It's difficult to try and figure out how some of these things are going to be funded. And I think without some of the program funds that we used to have, that it's going to be even more difficult in the future to expect problem solving to come out of that area. I was also at a meeting this last week of the deer hunters, with a wildlife meeting with hunters and wildlife, and I thank the deer hunters who, like myself, are currently funding a lot of the fisheries program. And I don't know if that was well accepted or not, but it's a fact. Program funds have been severely depleted, and I would say too, if we have a problem with folks not being able to afford a license, like was mentioned, there's the half or two thirds price license. There's this program also raises the age to 18, which would allow for more of those youngsters that are getting a little older to be able to fish at no cost with their families. And I'm not totally happy with all the funding requests that are here, but I certainly do think that now is the time for an increase, and the increase we're talking about is about the equivalent of a box of night crawlers at Walmart, and that's not a lot. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lilienthal. I'll just have you sit tight in case there's a question while we go to Mr. Perovich.
Thank you, Chairman and members. My name is Peter Perovich. I am the current president of the Minnesota Bass Federation, and I'm here today to support Senator Chaudhry's bill for a license fee increase with some concerns from our membership and other anglers. With the increase, that we believe that there needs to be some, you know, responsibility and accountability from the DNR. Because as we talk to our members and other anglers around since the roundtable, and as Senator Chaudhry had expressed earlier, we do get the same question. What are they going to do with the money? And it's surprising to hear that from anglers. But, you know, with the way the economy is now, people want to know. They want to know what they're going to do with it. So that's one thing that we need to know, is what they're going to do with it. And I think the bill outlines what they're going to do with it. And we believe that with the increase in 2011 and another one in 2015, this is exactly what, you know, anglers like to see, you know, government do. I mean, we're putting a plan in place before the problem comes to surface. And this is something that is very appealing to our anglers out there. We're addressing the problem before it gets there. So we aren't all of a sudden having to increase it, you know, $8, $9, $10 to shore up the DNR come 2015. We also believe that, you know, this shouldn't be open-ended, that this money should be used for, you know, invasives, aquatic programs, education. It should be designated. A lot of our members have expressed that they don't want to, if we have to do an increase, they don't want to see this going for, you know, salaries and administrative costs. You know, that bothers them a lot. They want this to go back into the fisheries directly. So that basically is where the Bass Federation is at. You know, this is something that we found talking with even outside our membership and with anglers, you know, around the area and statewide, because we do have our members who who are from around the state, from the northern, southern part of the state, that have talked to their people in their area, their clubs. And this is basically what we're bringing to you, is how they're feeling about this.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there questions? If not, we'll go to my right. I believe it's Paul.
Yes, sir.
Please identify yourself as you begin your testimony.
My name is Paul Perovich. I'm the state youth director for the Minnesota Bass Federation. As the youth director for the Minnesota Bass Federation, I run the largest youth fishing program in the state of Minnesota. I first of all support this bill with one exception. One of the key objectives of my program is growth, making it easier for kids to fish in our program and throughout the state. Annually, we touch over 5,000 kids with our program in the Minnesota Bass Federation. One would think that I'm all in favor of raising the age to 18 years old before you buy a license. I am not. I think that the owning a license at the age of 16 is very, very important. The Bass Angler Sportsman Society, of which the Minnesota Bass Federation is part of, runs the largest, most comprehensive, and the most demanding fishing program in the nation. Since 1991, we've touched over 3.5 million children. We've given away $1.2 million in scholarship money to those kids. This is a program that is based on getting kids and holding on to them, not just taking kids out fishing for a day. And what we have found, that if you can do this and create programs like this, we create sportsmen that are sportsmen for life. Normally, I get kids at 11 years old. They stay in the program until they're 18. This year, I have three of my graduates out of our program on the University of Minnesota fishing team. I have one is the current captain of the St. Cloud University fishing team. So they're staying in the fishing, which is what we need to have happen. Our program teaches a lot more than how to catch fish. The real goal of our program is that we produce young adults at the end of the tunnel that are headed for college, who have improved their skill sets that will make them successful students, successful in the workplace, and successful parents. Many of the things that have made all of you successful are the same things that make a fisherman successful. We've decided as a society that at the age of 16, our children are mature enough and responsible enough to receive one of the biggest gifts they will get, and that's a driver's license. It comes with it a whole lot of responsibility. The hunting license and the fishing license are exactly the same thing. It is a rite of passage. It has been tradition in Minnesota, and it should continue to be that. You know, there's a great movie out there called Drumline about southern colleges that have these great marching bands. And one of the band directors, when he was getting ready for a big contest, said, you have to take the old and mix it with the new. And it's time to take that license and dust it off, polish it off, and make sure that the kids understand what this thing is all about. It's a lot of responsibility when you give a 16-year-old a fishing license. Suddenly, they can take their little brothers and sisters fishing. They can take their nephews fishing. Before, they could not. So I think that this is a very, very, very important thing. Here's a couple stories I'd like to tell you if I could. First one is, I still have my first fishing license that I got when I was 16 years old. My dad took me up to the Holiday Station on West Main in Anoka. Actually, it was the Holiday Erickson then. And he bought it for me. I still have it. And I think there's a number of people in this room that might still have their fishing licenses. We consider it a very, very important thing in the Bass Federation within our youth program for the kids. We make sure that everybody knows when somebody has to have a license. And we make a big deal out of it. Last summer, I was fishing as a boat captain. I wasn't fishing. I was playing boat captain for one of our youth groups on Sylvan Lake. Game warden slid up next to us, and he asked to see my license because it's a requirement. I had a 16-year-old in the boat with me and an 11-year-old in the boat. I gave him my license. He said, that's great. Thanks a lot, guys. Have a good day. the game warden pushed away from my boat, and 16-year-old stepped up and goes, "Hey, don't you want to see my license?" The warden looked at him and said, "Well, young man, yes, I would." He slid back over. He looked at the license. He said, "Jacob, thank you very much." It is a point of pride for a lot of these kids that we don't want to take away from them. Some of the costs that I want to talk about, I've been told that it just isn't that much of a big deal for the costs. Now, these are the 2008 numbers that I got off the DNR website. We sold around 30,000 individual fishing licenses to 17 and under. At $18 a crack, that's $540,000. If we figure 20% of those kids go out and buy a trout stamp, that's another $60,000. That's $600,000 that we're going to lose out of the Treasury. We also lose the $4 of federal money per license. So it becomes $720,000 that we're going to lose. Another problem that we're going to have is that wildlife is going to step up and say, well, if kids under 16 or under 18 don't have to buy a license, what about that small game license? In 2008, we sold 60,000 small game licenses to our youth. That was $1.2 million. If you figure 50% of those kids bought a pheasant stamp, that's another $210,000, and if 50% bought that duck stamp, it's another $210,000. If you add it all up, we're over $2.3 million annually. I just don't think it's a good idea to take that kind of money out of the budget when we already have problems balancing it. In 22 years in the military and three commands, I found out many things. One of the things I demanded out of all my subordinates was, don't come to me with a problem unless you have an answer. My answer, and what I think would be a really good idea for this bill, would be to create an apprentice hunting and fishing license for the state of Minnesota. The state of Arizona has been using it since 2009, and it's been very, very successful. What this allows for is a licensed resident of the state of Minnesota, 18 years or older, could take somebody without a license out for 2 days. Now, they can go one day at a time, they could split it, whatever, but it makes it dramatically easier to get that spur of the moment, hey, do you want to go fishing tomorrow event, without saying, well, I got to go buy an $18 license. They're free, and we don't have to just do it for the kids. I think it should be done for everybody, because we're losing, the demographics are, we're losing everybody. We aren't just losing the kids, we're losing everybody. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Perovich. Are there questions? Thank you, gentlemen, for your testimony. I believe the Dark House Angling Association would like to speak to this bill. Tim Sprecht. And then we will hear from the commission, or from the DNR as well. Good afternoon. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Tim Spreck. I'm the president of the Minnesota Dark House Angling Association. We also sit on the board of directors for MOHA, but I'm here today on a dark house matter. I want to thank Senator Chaudhry for bringing this bill up for debate. I think it's a debate that we need to have. We do have some concerns as it pertains to the spearfishing license increases. This is no reflection on Senator Chaudhry in any way, because it appears that the percentage of increase is across the board. But there may be some people on this committee who are not really, really completely familiar with how the dark house licensing is arrived at. And when I say dark house, I mean spearing through the ice in the winter. Currently, as a dark house angler, we have to pay $17 for an angling license. On top of that, we also have to pay $18 for a spearing tag, which brings our total to $35 for the opportunity to spearfish through the ice. All other game fishermen at this time are paying only $17. There's a disparity there in the amount of dollars that we're paying versus what muskie fishermen, bass fishermen, walleye fishermen, pan fishermen are paying. One other important point to add to this discussion is that pike management costs the DNR virtually nothing. We're aware of only one small stocking episode in the southern part of the state. Pike are naturally reproducing. They maintain their levels. They don't require any management of any kind. No other game fish angler has to pay a stamp fee, and as a result of this, we've called the fee that we pay to practice our sport of spearing a spearing penalty. The one exception to that would be the trout stamp, which is dedicated trout money. Trout fisherman pays $10, and that money is dedicated to specific trout initiatives. In our opinion, this is unfair, and it was done years and years ago to make spearfishing more expensive, and as a result, less people would partake of it. My specific concerns go to line 1.22 in the bill as it's proposed. This line raises the spearfishing penalty rate so that in order for us to partake of our sport in the year 2011, we would be paying $42. Line 2.5 further increases this rate in 2015. The new cost to spear will be $50. Also keep in mind that our season runs virtually for about 3 months from December through February. So for $50, we have the opportunity to practice our sport for only 3 months. By comparison, all other forms of fishing have seasons that last quite a bit longer. And the other thing to remember is that when we stock and manage these particular species, those being bass, walleye, and muskie, the expenses are fairly substantial for the department. I also see there's provisions for increases in the non-resident fee. I'm sorry, I didn't know there was a page 2 to this bill until I got here today. It looks like it's going to be $38 for a non-resident. Maybe our DNR friends can help us here. I don't know, since this was a new provision this year, if the non-residents have to buy a $38 angling license plus a $38 spearing tag. If that's the case, I would be concerned about that as well. If it is not the case, I think $38 is fine and fair for non-residents.
We'll ask that question.
We'll ask that, Mr. Spreck.
In conclusion, here's what I would like to propose to this committee, and hopefully there will be somebody who will undertake this opportunity to make an amendment for a return to fairness to spear fishermen statewide. I have two options on the table. One would be to repeal the spearing penalty, let us pay the same amount as other anglers. It's fair, it's equitable, it makes a lot of sense. We don't have a problem paying $21. We think that that money would be well spent to preserve and enhance the fishing opportunity for all of us. The other option, if you don't find that palatable in a difficult economic situation, would be to reduce our $18 spearing penalty to $10 so that we would come in compliance with trout. We wouldn't ask at this time for that to be dedicated to any specific initiative, but we understand that for us, $10 would not be a hardship, and it would be a move in the right direction. When you hear the people outside hollering that they need jobs, and they need jobs now, those are our people out there, folks. We're blue-collar. We've always been blue-collar. It's not a sport for the elite. It's a harvest sport. We're putting food on the table, and it's time to address this issue, and this gives us a forum and an opportunity to really take advantage of it today. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Spreck. Question, Senator Ingebretson.
Mr. Chair, I would like to make that as an amendment if I could, if the chair would so accept to reduce that thing to $10, that dark house fee to $10.
And let me, Chair, Senator Ingebretson, could we complete the testimony and then?
Oh, I'm sorry.
Take amendments?
Certainly.
End of testimony? Any follow-up, Senator Ingebretson, or is that?
No, I do have some questions, though, when the DNR is going to be doing their testimony. Yeah.
Appreciate that.
Thank you.
Now we're going to hear from the muskies. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself as you begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and distinguished members of the committee. My name is Sean Kellett. I'm the Vice President of the Twin Cities Chapter of Muskies Incorporated, as well as being a board member of Anglers for Habitat. I don't know why Tim here is, he had to pick out the muskies first in his testimony and picking on them. I would like the record to show today is March 10th. 2010, 1:50 p.m., and I will go on record saying that it is absolutely silly that these guys have to pay twice to enjoy their sport.
Can I hug you now?
we've battled tooth and nail on other issues, so thank you for the support.
Unless it's on the agenda, take it out in the hall.
Exactly. I actually was not aware of that, and at least not to this degree, but I think that, speaking for myself, I would support that amendment. And we all know how cats and dogs all live together.
To the bill?
To the bill.
Thank you.
Sorry. Regarding the muskie interest as a part of this, Minnesota, about 3 or 4 years ago, and Muskies Inc. did a poll, and for the first time ever, Minnesota was the number one destination for muskie fishermen who are going to travel out of their state. It, for the prior about 35 years, that had been Canada. We are very supportive in increasing this funding to our DNR to help us maintain the quality of muskie fishing we have and hopefully even improve it and expand it. We're very big believers in the old statement of if you build it, they will come. We've built it, they're coming, and we need to be able to maintain that right now. And just one other just position or just observation from my local DNR office. These cuts are really hitting home. I know in my local office in the West Metro, they do have one position that's unfulfilled. And a lot of those man hours, actually, our club is helping donate to do some of these pulling the nets and a lot of the dirty work that that we would be paying otherwise. So we are for this 100%. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Thank you, gentlemen. Anyone else before we have the department come forward that would like to speak to this bill? Welcome to the committee. If you could identify yourself as you begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is John Lincheski. I'm with Minnesota Trout Unlimited, and I'll be brief. Trout Unlimited in general supports this fishing license fee increase. We've had a growing concern with what we perceive as dropping funding levels within the department, and they've been being asked to do more for less for a number of years, and I think at this point our observation is that they've been cut to the bone, at least in the fisheries department. There are about 30 positions now vacant, and we're concerned about the impact on effective management by that. We strongly support science-based management, and that depends upon personnel, good personnel doing good survey work, collecting good data, and doing good research. And DNR does have good field staff. Unfortunately, the numbers have dwindled, and we're interested in seeing that reversed. I'll just point out the connection with, say, the legacy funding funds projects, but I think all those projects depend upon the good work of the DNR, the good fisheries professionals, wildlife professionals. They really have the technical expertise to make sure that those projects are done right and in the right places. So we do think that this, you know, the increasing funding for the fisheries department, the section, is very important. So we would support this fee increase. So thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lincheski. Any other questions for the witness? If not, I'd ask, I believe Dave Shad and Bob Meyer prepared to come to the committee. Good afternoon, gentlemen. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. For the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner of the DNR. I'm just going to have some opening comments and let Director Shad of our Fish and Wildlife Division address some of the specifics in the bill. First of all, I just want to clarify for the record, there has been some confusion on the department's position on the license fee increase. We are neutral on the fee increase at this point in time. We did evaluate the need to raise fishing licenses at this point in time. However, looking at the balances in the fund and the current spending and the pressures we're under otherwise as a department and the state budgetarily, we just felt this year wasn't the time for us to come forward with an increase, but we do understand the need and the desire of the sportsmen and women of the state, and we'll work with them and you to show where the money is being spent should you desire to move this forward. So I just wanted to clarify that first of all, and then just briefly to talk about ELS agent situation right now. We're in the process of going from about 1,600 terminals down to about 1,400. We've reissued our contract. We're simplifying the system, getting new systems in place, actually bringing down the cost, the service fee cost on the online. It used to be $3 for an online service fee transaction. Now we're going to a 3% fee, like the agents are able to recover when you use a credit card at the Holiday Station or at Cabela's, wherever you're going to go. So the costs are going to come down. But with that, we've also looked at the number of licenses that agents have sold throughout the state. There were some licensed agents who were selling 50 to 100 licenses a year, and it costs us about $1,000 per terminal to support those machines. So we're reissuing terminals. We're also developing an online small vendor website that will be available later this summer that these small mom-and-pop resorts will be able to be a member of, be able to operate just like they do with the terminal, but just through the web. And we're in the process of evaluating the appeals that we've had. There's about a handful of resorters that did not get terminals at this point in time. I'm hopeful that we can meet all of their needs within the next couple of weeks so everybody will be happy. Some of them, we're going to be issuing them terminals with the agreement that once the online situation, online small vendor website is up, that they will then turn that terminal back in and then just operate off of that system. And I think everybody is very happy with the situation we have at hand on that. But with that, we've learned there's a lot of people who will do this for free. A lot of people will be DNR vendors, sell licenses for free because they want to. They get added business into their stores, things like that. So one of the concerns we do have is the increase in the vendor, the issuing fees. And I was just thinking as I was looking at this bill for a person who has the opportunity maybe to go fishing, bear hunting, bow hunting, rifle hunting, and muzzleloader hunting in a year, that's going to be an additional $5 that person has to pay for those transaction costs. So every transaction that's going to be there is going to be a dollar, not just for a fishing license fee increase. And so when you think about the increase, it's going to go from $21 to $23.50, actually, with those vendor increases in there as well. And that's what we hear about is how much somebody pays when they pay the bottom line, not how much they pay for the actual license. So that's just one of our concerns. We feel there's a lot of people who will do this for free. I understand the need some people may feel to get an additional dollar out of the transaction, but more often than not, we have people knocking on our doors to do this rather than turning them back into us because they are losing money on the terminal. So with that, if there are no other questions, I'll turn it over to Director Shad.
Director, Senator Stone.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Does you say if the governor supports this?
Mr. Meyer?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stump, we haven't had discussions with the governor or finance on a fishing license fee increase, but the department is neutral at this point in time.
Follow-up?
Yes, I was just, you know, this is more of a finance issue, but I'm just thinking I think the department was requested by the governor to do a 5% reduction across, I mean, to kind of come up with the governor's budget. Was it about a 5% reduction?
Between 5 and 6.
Assistant Commissioner?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator Self, we've ran many different scenarios, 3, 5, 6, general fund. We've looked at natural resource holdbacks as well, but none of that is in the governor's budget at this time.
Senator Stumpf.
I'm just thinking that you could have a scenario here where you have an increase in licenses, license fees, and yet a reduction in services, not only this year, but next year as well, in the next 2 years, actually. Because if you look at the overall budget, no matter how you cut it, we're going to have a reduction this year. And then at best case scenario, with the most favorable increase in taxes, you're going to have a reduction in state spending the next 2 years beyond the current fiscal year. So I'm just thinking out loud here about how the perception is out there in the public when you raise licenses and yet lose services. And I don't know what the answer is. You know, the answer could be, you know, just jack up the licenses. I don't know.
Senator Chaudhry, to that point?
Mr. Chair, Senator Stumpf, this is not general fund money that we're raising fees for. It's a dedicated game and fish fund, and it's something that we have to have as well because we get federal matching dollars. The most important point, however, is that in this area, there is almost no general fund money that goes towards this area. That's been cut, and even though it's basically what I've been saying in our proportional cut discussions has occurred in the game and fish area. When we cut more of a percentage than what it is of the general fund, you're going to end up at zero eventually, and that's what's happened with the game and fish in the game and fish and wildlife areas. We've been doing, you know, 3, 5, 7% cuts, saying that that's across the board when it's really only a minute percentage of the actual general fund. So we've ended up zeroing it out pretty much. So this is all we've got now, for the most part, in maintaining these operations. And the finances are as such that it's going to go into the red in 2012 or 2013.
Senator Ingebrigtsen, did you want to weigh in now or wait until we've heard from Mr. Shad?
If I could take a few minutes to talk to Commissioner outside and address it as soon as he's done with his testimony, that'd be
all right.
The other thing, Mr. Chair, I'd like to make Chaudhry. Is that we're raising some fees, but we are eliminating fees on some people as well, including the young people. And one thing I realized after Senator Anderson's comments earlier, last year, I think it was the year before, we eliminated the need for a fishing license in all Minnesota state parks. So we've been steadily reducing fees. And if you remember Irene Long, we even eliminated licenses for her and anyone else over 90. So the anglers have stepped up to the plate and said, yes, we agree with that stuff, but we need a place to fish in the first place as well.
Director Shad, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Dave Shad, Fish and Wildlife Director for DNR. And to Senator Chaudhry's last point, he's correct in that the Division of Fish and Wildlife right now is almost entirely funded by hunters and anglers, either through state license fees or in federal funds that are collected from excise taxes on arms and ammunition and angling equipment. And so there's very little general fund support provided for fish and wildlife management in the state right now. And I think it's really remarkable, and we really appreciate the fact that anglers have organized themselves to kind of bring this forward. I think hunters and anglers have always seen the need to reinvest in conservation and in their sport. And this is remarkable, I think, that they've gone ahead and done that. As Commissioner Meyer said, we did take a close look at the need for a fee increase as we looked at supplemental budget this year. And we looked at two areas of concern. And one was the Game and Fish Fund balance. Senator Chaudhry mentioned earlier that based on the February forecast, that fund balance is projected to be at about $4.2 million at the end of FY13, and that assumes stable levels of funding. So that assumes that we wouldn't fund inflationary increases in the next biennium. Certainly no new room for new initiatives with that fund balance. It's a small enough fund balance that depending on what happens, for example, with deer populations and deer hunting license sales, we really risk putting that fund into the red. So there is a fund balance projected, but it's not a real a large balance there. The fiscal note that we developed, and we just finished work on it today on this bill, indicates we generate about $1.8 to $1.9 million annually into the fund as a result of this increase. So certainly a fee increase would help the fund balance, but we thought, based on the state of the balance, that we could address the need for a fee as part of our banning a budget package a year from now rather than move it forward right now. The other issue that's been touched on a little bit here, and it's been an important issue for the Game and Fish Fund Budget Oversight Committee, is the relative imbalance between hunting and angling expenditures and revenues. Right now, we're spending about 92% of hunting revenue on wildlife-related programs, and we're spending about 112% of fishing revenue on angling revenue on fishing programs. So we're actually spending more on fishing programs than we're generating from all sources of angling revenue. We're spending significantly less on our wildlife programs than hunters are generating through both state licenses and excise taxes. Right now, fishing expenditures exceed revenues by about $4.5 million annually. So this bill would address less than half of that $4.5 million gap, basically. And the hunters have pointed out through the Budget Oversight Committee process that they believe this should be rectified, they believe that these angling programs should pay for themselves. So that's an important issue. We've looked at a number of initiatives over the years to either try to reduce hunting-related revenue to try to get at this balance a little bit, or to certainly address some of our fisheries programs to try to reduce expenditures in the absence of new fisheries revenue. Just a little bit on where we're at with our fisheries management budget and our programs. We haven't been funded for any inflationary costs. We've lost general fund in the last couple of bienniums here, so we are getting smaller, as some of the testifiers have indicated. We are doing more with less with our fisheries programs. We're down about 30 FTEs from where we were in 2007. We anticipate continued attrition over the next 15 months, the remainder of this fiscal year, and at current levels of expenditure, we would anticipate an additional 20 to 25 FTEs to be lost in the next biennium. So we are getting smaller. We are looking at some programmatic reductions. We've reduced in a number of areas already and are continuing to evaluate our programs to look for efficiencies in those programs, but also to kind of recast our programs, so to speak, and really focus on the highest priority work that provides the best return to the anglers. Maybe just a couple of comments finally on a few elements of the bill. The 16 and 17-year-old provision that would provide free licenses, there is a budget impact to that. Our fiscal note indicates it's about $680,000 in lost revenue based on the current license fee. There's an additional cost to that, though, in that we would no longer be able to count those 16 and 17-year-olds as anglers as we compete with other states for these federal dollars, our apportionment. And we estimate for each angler that we lose about $4 in federal funds as a result of that. There are some guidelines in place that the federal agencies have developed that in order for a license to count, it needs to be at least $1, and the license fee needs to at least cover the costs of issuing that license. And so we've estimated that's somewhere in the range of $2 to $2.50, and that nominal fee, if it was applied to 16 and 17-year-olds, for example, would allow us to continue to capture that $4 per angler federal aid reimbursement to the state. So I guess that's food for thought as you move forward with this.
What's the additional amount?
That would there's our estimate is about 32,000 16 and 17 year olds buying licenses. So at $4 a piece, it's about $125,000 hit to our federal apportionment.
Other comments, Director?
I think with that, I'll close and take some questions.
Right. Questions for Director Shad? One question that came from some of our other testimony was, what are you going to do with the money? I think you kind of walked us down part of that path. Their concern certainly seemed to be full-time employees as you look at your budget and these increases, do you have a plan specifically for $1.6 million or whatever it is you think it might generate?
Well, I think Mr. Chairman, I think that's an important question and something that we need to have more discussion around. I pointed out this imbalance between the wildlife or the hunting side and the angling side, if we were to increase license fees for angling and then turn around and spend those fees on fisheries programs, that entire amount of fees on fisheries programs, we wouldn't address that gap or that imbalance at all. It would continue as it has been. And so I think it's an important policy discussion here that we all need to have. You know, the fishery and the wildlife funds have been commingled from day one. It's also how most other states treat these funds, and I think the thought has always been that we should use that fund to address the most important conservation needs, regardless of whether they're on the fishery side of things or on the wildlife side of things. The Budget Oversight Committee has identified the need to try to start to bring these two things into balance, and certainly a fee increase would help that. But again, if we turn around and spend all of that on fisheries programs, we're really not moving forward and addressing that imbalance. So I think that would be an issue that we should address as part of the biennial budget discussion a year from now.
We do have four other bills, and this is deadline day, so we do want to keep moving. I was going to ask you, Director Shad, though, we had a question whether or not non-resident spear fishermen were getting nicked twice. Could you answer that question?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the same requirement applies to both residents and non-residents. They're required to have both that dark house license and a angling license.
Senator Ingebretson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment, and then I'm going to ask for Mr. Knopf's help here with an amendment. But with the dark house situation in Minnesota, and I think Cass Lake probably brought it to the forefront here, and that hasn't been resolved yet, and that's, I guess, a different day. But it appears that there might be some movement towards eliminating that, and that's the fear of the folks that I'm representing, as well as those that I know that love to spear in Minnesota. With dark house, but the bottom line is right now there's approximately 25 lakes that are banned from spearing right now, and 125 that are restricted. And I think maybe the DNR may have the science for some of these lot size restriction lakes, but it's somewhat unclear as to whether the science is actually there on Cass Lake. But again, that's a different day. But I am very concerned about them being treated differently. What I would like to do, and again ask Mr. Knopf if I could just do it by way of oral amendment, line 122 of the bill, as well as line 2.5, which addresses the 2015 fee, actually reducing that $17 fee to $10 on both lines. If you could help me word that, I would like to make that a oral amendment and would
the non-resident.
Thank you.
The non-resident too.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, that's a
Mr. Knopf.
That it would just be on line 1.22, delete $21 and insert $10 on line 2.5, insert or delete $25 and insert $10. I didn't know if you wanted there is a non-resident issue though too on 2.23. I don't know if it matters whether that one is.
Let's do that too.
So,
That one as well. That one probably, I think probably we're okay with that one.
Let's reduce that too.
You want to reduce that
too? Senator
Chaudhry? Yeah, that'd be fine. Sure.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Chaudhry, Senator Ingebrigtsen, what do you want to reduce that to? To the same $10, or do you want to go higher than that?
Well, I would certainly say in proportion. Mr. Chair, in proportion to the same drop. I don't know exactly what percentage
that
would be.
Why don't we just make it around $20, Mr. Chairman?
That would be fine, if that's acceptable to the author.
Members, we have an oral amendment before us on line 1.22. Delete 21 and make that 10. On line 2.5, delete 25 and make that $10. And on line 2.23, delete 38 and make that $20.
Mr. Chairman?
Senator Olson.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that brings it to less than what the others are doing, but I'm not sure I understand why we have the two. I understood the testifier to say that, you know, the double fee of the $25 for spearing from a dark house, that they had no objection to raising it to 21 for taking a fish spearing, but why are we doing it double? Why aren't we just eliminating that second one to take fish by spearing from a dark house, that additional $25? I'm not sure what the rationale is and how much money would be lost if that were done.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Mr. Chair and Senator, I'm not following that question. I guess reducing it to $10 on both levels there and 20 on the simple non-resident license.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ingebrigtsen, 10 and 10 makes 20, and the other ones are going to 21. So you're actually having it a dollar less by the combination, but. Am I misreading this, that you're actually charging twice? They're right now they're paying the 17 and they're paying, or no, we're adding another one for the 25?
Senator Chaudhry.
Are they paying a double amount twice?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, yes, they are. And what the suggestion was from the Dark House Association was, and that is what Senator Ingebrigtsen is proposing, is that we bring it into parity with what some of the other fishing groups pay in terms of their stamp. For example, the trout fishermen pay for an angling fee, angling license, and they pay for a trout stamp. So this would bring it in more of a parity with that. Okay. Now, the rationale for another stamp or license at all for spearing, maybe I think that's a longer discussion for another day, but I think this brings it back to parity as was with other angling activities.
We have the oral amendment before us. Senator Kielash, was this to the amendment or did you have another question?
No, it was another question.
To the Ingebrigtsen amendment, further questions? All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Senator Kielash.
Mr. Chair, I was wondering, Mr. Chedek, I was wondering with the reductions in the past few years on personnel, what has that done to the ability of the DNR to provide fry or whatever to the general public? Have we reduced the amount of production and the services we're able to provide because of that reduction?
Director Shad.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kielash, we have reduced some of our programs, but not our stocking efforts. We've been able to maintain, for the most part, our stocking programs. We have made some refinements in our stocking programs, both on the walleye side, where we've worked with an advisory committee to look at getting more efficient and making sure we're stocking the right fish in the right amounts in the right lakes and that sort of thing. And we've recently undertaken a kind of a top-to-bottom review of our cold water production program and stocking efforts, and we found some efficiencies there. But we haven't had to, as a result of budget issues, reduce stocking efforts. We've reduced in other areas of our programs.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, additional funding would be used for what part of the program, or to increase the services that you're able to provide for that?
Director Shad.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Kelash, you know, the reductions that we've put into place have been primarily in the areas of staff, and these are biologists. These are folks out on the ground that are doing lake surveys, writing management plans, working with the public to develop regulations, stocking plans, and that sort of thing. So we're getting out to those lakes less frequently. And we don't have the certainty about what's happening in some of those systems as a result of that. So that's certainly one thing we'd want to build back. The other thing that we've really cut back on pretty significantly are what we call creel surveys. These are surveys of anglers to determine catch rates, size of fish, that sort of thing. And they're a very important tool to see if our management programs are working or not. We've had to eliminate most of those creel surveys. We still do them on a few of our very large walleye lakes and Lake Superior, but even on some of those large lakes, we've either reduced or eliminated those creels. So those are two areas that if we were to see some additional dollars appropriated, that we'd want to build back.
Thank you.
Further questions? Senator Chaudhry.
Move that Senate File 3044 as amended be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Finance.
To that motion, any questions? All those, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, I found the testimony of Mr. Perovich rather compelling relative to that raising of age to 18 for free licenses. Did that have any impact on you, Senator Chaudhry?
Senator Chaudhry.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I've gone over that that issue in my mind quite a bit. And I think Mr. Perovich is right in a lot of aspects. For me, it is the overarching need to get more young people into angling that is most important to me, and to reduce any potential barrier that could do that. And the angling community has been willing to step up and say we will raise our own license fee so all kids can fish for free. That means that as a school activity, a teacher can take their students fishing, regardless of their age, whether they're a junior or senior in high school, without having to go through purchasing of a fee, purchasing of a license. That is a big deal. That is a big deal, and we're going to have to do that increasingly in our schools. But more so, when you look at the demographics of who is fishing and who is taking kids fishing, it's not necessarily the parent anymore that should have the responsibility for footing such a bill. It's a mentor. It's an uncle. I think this would also be a release of that burden, to be able to very easily take a kid fishing anytime you wanted to. I think it's the signature measure of this bill of raising this fee is to step up and do this for the kids of Minnesota. And I would just conclude, Mr. Chairman, by saying all Minnesotans, not just anglers, benefit from this license fee increase in well-managed fisheries. All Minnesotans benefit. But it is the sportsmen that are stepping up to pay more.
Further questions? If not, Senator Chaudhry removes his motion that Senate File 3044 is amended, be recommended to pass and referred to Finance. To that motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you. Senator Rummel.
Chair members.
Such thing.
Members, before us, Senator Rummel's bill, Senate File 3138. Senator Rummel, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Committee members,
Senate File 3138 is a bill is dealing with monitoring of our groundwaters. But before we begin, I have an oral amendment, if that's all right.
This your first stop, Senator Rummel?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
All right, members, if you will find your handout for Senate File 3138, Senator Rummel, take us to the amendment.
The amendment's on page 4, line 19.
Page 4, line 19.
I would like you to strike the number 100 and insert the number 120.
Inserting 120 for 100.
And then after the word feet, would you insert a comma, on average, comma.
Line 4.19, strike 100 and insert 120. After feet, there's a comma, on average, comma.
And then on line 422.
422.
Strike the number 50 and insert the number 30. Committee members, these dimensions simply put the numbers in conformity with the current dimensions of easements, and so it's more accurate.
To the oral amendment by Senator Rummel, those in questions? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. Senator Rummel, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We will proceed quickly. This bill deals with the monitoring requirements in the 11 county metro area. Is that right? We will be basically. I will be asking testifiers to present two reports that have been required by the legislature. The bill is based on the findings and the reports, so it's necessary for us to go through the reports. I'm hoping they can go through them quickly. I have with me Julie Blackburn from Bowser, who will address the Clean Water Fund issues in the bill. Then Dan Lutke, who will discuss the legislative requirements of the report. So I will turn the testimony over to Julie.
Thank you, Senator. Julie Blackburn, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself as you begin your testimony.
Thank you. I'm Julie Blackburn, Assistant Director for the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources, and I'm here to very briefly summarize the Board of Water and Soil Resources activities implementing the Clean Water Fund appropriations for this year. We were required to submit a report to you on March 1st, and we did submit the report, the full report, to you, and it's available electronically on our website. What I've done is put together a PowerPoint, and I handed out the handout of the presentation to you, just highlighting what we have done so far with implementing those appropriations. As you know, the Minnesota Board of Water and Soil Resources is your state conservation agency, and we do implementation statewide on local water management planning and implementing lake and river protection efforts. So on your handout that you have, you'll see that we received $18 million this fiscal year. Most of those funds are funneled out through a competitive grant process to eligible units of government. In fact, the majority of the funds are through the competitive process. We also had two pass-through direct appropriations, and we had two different conservation easement programs that were implemented through our Reinvest in Minnesota program. Our competitive ranking criteria, just so you know, we did go out in October 1st and went for a competitive application. We received 244 applications totaling over $44 million in requests for the $11 million that we had available. We did rank them based on qualitative outcomes, the amount of citizen engagement that they would have, their readiness to proceed, consistency with groundwater plans, all of that is in there. We have an extensive review program in order to make sure that the best quality projects are funded. And I'm not going to go through any of those details. I wanted to just highlight a couple of the different results that we received from this. We received grant applications from all over the state. A couple of the projects you see in here, one of them is the Minnehaha Creek Watershed District, which is a citizen-engaged project. putting in rain gardens, pervious pavers, things like that in order to work on the Diamond Lake impairment in South Minneapolis. That's one of our metro projects. We also have extensions on CRP contracts to have CRP in place an additional 10 years. We also have up in Pelican River Watershed District, they are restoring a lake that had been drained and ditched. And in order to restore that lake, the project actually started more than a decade ago. We are partnering with the federal government that's putting in WRP easements and reducing phosphorus in the Detroit Lakes chain of lakes by 50%. Obviously, that's an important area for tourism, fisheries, and all of that. So that's an important project. There's lots of important projects on here. I know you have a very busy agenda, so I'm going to just highlight SSTS projects. Over 30 lakes are going to be inventoried on where we have failing and imminent health threats. We are taking care of 53 feedlot projects throughout the state. We're providing technical assistance in a match of with a federal match of $2.5 million coming to the state, putting in conservation drainage projects throughout the state. By the way, I do want to mention conservation drainage. We only had $200,000 available. We received over $1 million in applications. That's five times the amount of funding we had available. All of these projects, including the riparian buffers, the last couple of slides are on the riparian buffer easements. We had $3 million available this year. The sign-up lasted less than 2 months. The $3 million was already signed up and gone. We already, in the next month and a half, have had enough sign-ups to take care of next year's $3 million appropriation. So it's a very successful program. Those projects that we're putting in and why we asked for the 120 adjustment on that line 419 was because we're putting them on top of CRP lands, acres that are currently in CRP. That's really what is in CRP right now. That's the standard width. So what we're going out is we're looking at conservation that's already been paid for by the federal government and putting in protection that's permanent over the top of it. Like I said, the $6 million in this biennium is already spoken for. On the second-to-last slide is the wellhead protection easements. Those are extraordinarily targeted towards the most vulnerable wellheads in the state. We work with the Department of Health on those. We have $1 million available each year in order to put in conservation easements on those lands. And, again, those are going very, very, very quickly. We wanted to give you those updates because I believe that's consistent with what is in this bill, the three items under Subdivision 3 for the Board of Water and Soil Resources. Wanted to make sure you knew that we've already been able to get this funding out on the ground, taking care of surface waters and groundwater. So that's all I'm going to comment on with this, unless you have any questions.
Ms. Blackburn, thank you for your brevity. Questions? And I appreciate the packet. We can certainly get a hold of you if there are questions. Mr. Luthy, is it?
Yes. Mr. Chairman and members, my name is Dave Luthy. I'm with the Department of Natural Resources Division of Waters. I will help you understand the background behind our October 1st report. It's the 11-county plan for a monitoring network for the groundwater resources. And this came about as a result of session laws in 2009. That I will just read briefly so you understand the scope of it is that we were requested to design a network so that the wells can be used to identify threats to groundwater quality and institute practices to protect groundwater from degradation. The network must be sufficient to ensure that water use in the metropolitan area does not harm ecosystems, degrade water quality, or compromise the ability of future generations to meet their own needs. We surrounded ourselves with a team of experts from the U.S. Geological Survey, the Minnesota Geological Survey, Met Council, Health, Ag, PCA, local units of government, and so we had and the University of Minnesota, and we worked together to address how we would best address the challenge in front of us. We produced this 50-page report. You have the 6 pages, the cover, the inside cover that shows the representatives who are involved with this, plus the executive summary. We basically have the need to do four major components to answer these questions adequately for the metropolitan area. We need to have establish and expand a long-term monitoring network of observation wells that track the aquifers in the metropolitan area outside of the zones of direct pumping influence. And so when people pump their wells in the aquifers, it causes an influence in that particular area. We want to know what's going on in the aquifer as a whole outside of those areas of direct influence from pumping. We call it a backbone network. It gives us an indication of what's happening in the aquifer as a whole. We need to do instrumentation of that network. We've typically relied on hand measurements, largely from like soil and water conservation districts and other volunteer readers or paid readers to capture monthly data as we look to manage these systems that we depend on for the public health, the population of the metropolitan area, the economic engine that it provides, as well as the ecosystem. We need to have a better understanding of that system, so we need to do some instrumentation so we get more real-time information and understand how those systems are working, the results of pumping impacts of the many different places of appropriation taking place and its effect on the system as a whole. We need to develop an automated system working with our users as partners. They are pumping in many different places. We need to capture information from those operations that should be relatively easy to capture in terms of data as they monitor their well fields and their pumping. We would have the need to capture that information about their individual cones of depression or how the water is being drawn down in their particular area, added to the network that we would be outside of that so that we understand the pumping centers, what's happening in the aquifer as a whole. It gives us a better ability to understand how the system plumbing is working as a whole. And so it will improve our ability to manage that, working with our partners to make better decisions on how to protect that for long term. And then finally, we need to capture that information. We'll need to we aren't currently capturing that much information, so we'll have to have some data system improvements to have that larger amount of information coming in, do some analysis, provide tools and products back to our local users to help them understand what's happening in the aquifers and the response to the pumping. This becomes also another method to help water quality managers as we understand the plumbing and how water moves from here to there and how the pumping impacts affect the whole. We'll be able to understand what direction water would be moving better to help decision-making should we have pollution concerns or contaminant concerns and what direction they may be moving. It will help us understand that system. In summary, basically, we look at plasma TV and high-definition TV. We like to have lots of pixels and understanding of what's going on. We look at the surface of the landscape. We've authorized LIDAR to understand more exactly what's happening on the surface of the landscape. Under the groundwater systems, we have very few points of reference to know what's happening. We're connecting the dots and drawing an artist's rendition of what's going on down there. And as we depend on this system for this economic and public health, we need to have a better understanding of how that plumbing works and how the water quantity and quality would be affected by our decisions. And so this is the background behind the bill and where we, as a groundwater technical professionals and water managers in the state, feel that is an important step that we need to move forward to manage those systems for the long term.
Thank you for your testimony. Questions for this witness? Senator Phoebe.
Mr. Chair, and I'm not sure who to direct this to, but in the bill, I think I have the right bill in front of me, 3016. You were talking about 11 county area, and in Section 4, it says Sections 1 to 3 apply in the counties of Anoka, Carver, Dakota, Hennepin, Ramsey, Scott, and Washington.
Senator Phoebe, this is Senate File 3138.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Senator
Seaman. Mr. Chair, I'm trying to just understand this, Senator Rummel, but help me understand when PFCs, for example, were found in the groundwater in some areas that I represent in the East Metro area. It was mainly the Department of Health that monitored those, the pollution and give guidance and set the groundwater limits. So how, and it seems like most of the money here is going to the DNR. So can you help me understand the difference? Or
I'll ask Mr. Luthi to answer that question.
Mr. Luthi.
Mr. Chair, Senator Seaman, The Department of Natural Resources is charged with managing the quantity of water in the state. The health department looks at public water supply, drinking water protection, and as a result of the reference you're referring to is that there was a concern about contaminants in those aquifers. The Department of Health was concerned about where it was moving to, and so their hydrologists worked to help identify where that those contaminants were moving to and from. This is the type of information that, as we are presenting here, will help better understand that system so that if we were to have additional occurrences, we have a better understanding so that they were out doing a lot of measurements and trying to figure out where it was going to and how quickly it was getting there in response to that. Our process will help understand that in advance so that when we have problems, we will know that rather than having to quickly try to respond to emergencies.
And then a follow-up question, thank you, is then why is this money going to the PCA to establish water quality standards for nitrogen, not the Department of Health?
Mr. Luthy?
I don't have the copy of the bill in front of me, but there are several things in the bill, and the money for nitrate is for something else. Our part is for a groundwater level monitoring network that I've just described, and so there are other parts for that I cannot answer.
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Anderson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sieben, the Health Department would establish human health guidelines for contaminants in water, but the PCA would establish guidelines for pollution of the surface the waters themselves to the aquatic habitat and the wildlife, et cetera.
Senator Sieben.
Thank you. No, that answers it. Thank you.
I do want to alert anyone that might want to speak against this bill to show themselves, because as we move through our crunch for time here, we want to move right along. Is this Mr. Elverum?
This is Mr. Jim Japs, and he would address the fee part of this bill.
Okay, Mr.
Since
Japs.
Since that's the part that's going to raise the most questions.
Welcome to the committee, and please identify yourself as you begin your testimony.
Jim Japs, Assistant Director, DNR Division of Waters. On the last page of the executive summary, there shows a cost of $8.8 million to complete this 11-county monitoring program. And I just wanted to speak to those two provisions in the bill. First, there's Section 3, lines starting with 3.30, which comes from the Clean Water Fund. That would be $5 million. And then the one that I think has the most interest is in Section 1, and it's lines 3.1 to 3.14. And there's a handout that you should have that just talks a little bit of background about this proposal. And it gives some examples of current fees and then gets into specific water uses in the Metro County. We basically use between 109 and 144 billion gallons a year in the 11-county metro area. There's a breakdown of that by public water supply, industrial, irrigation, and other uses. And using this 0.0008 cents per gallon, which equals $8 per million gallons, you can see how those sectors would be affected by that fee. Also put in here, there's not in here, but basically there's the 100 largest water users in the Metro County would be paying about 73% of the total fees for this. There's some examples of public water suppliers, Edina, Wyoming, two different communities. Just looking at the reported water use and population data that they provide the department every year, it would break down to about 32 cents per person, or 69 cents per household in Edina. And in Wyoming, it would be 22 cents per person, or about 63 cents per household there. Gave some estimates for agricultural irrigation, golf course, and industrial users, too.
Questions for Mr. Japs? Seeing none, Mr. Johnson and Mr. Olson are at the table. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I'm here with the League of Minnesota Cities. I will keep my remarks brief given the number of things you've got to do.
Thank you.
Start with the fact that, Mr. Chair and members, that the League of Minnesota City Board of Directors has just found out about this bill. It was just recently introduced, and our first opportunity for them to discuss it is a week from today at our board meeting, actually next Thursday. So they will be discussing this issue at that time. In the meantime, we'll be working with the author on several issues of concern related to this. One, obviously, is that this is not a good time for any city functions. Our revenues are low. Mr. Olson has some data on what's happening to city water utilities and their collection of revenues. You can guess it's not going very well right now. But secondly, we do have some concerns that this might be a duplication of effort. Our cities, in particular in the metro area, have pretty sophisticated amounts of information and mapping on groundwater supply and what they have, because they're each individually responsible for meeting those needs. It's not a regional system. So we have some concerns that there really hasn't been a stop long enough to find out what information is really needed and how much of this entire plan we really need to replicate and how much might already exist. And then more specifically for members, the fee right now is set at a rate that's $8 per million gallons. That does cover the cost of setting about 600 wells and the associated work that DNR could go on in detail telling you what it is. The out years, however, for this program, if you look at their report, say that they will need about $800,000 a year to keep the wells serviced and to keep accessing the data and accumulating it. The fee, however, collects almost $1.1 million per year. And so my suggestion would be that in the out years, after the first 4 years when the well systems are established, if this idea moves forward, the fee would more appropriately drop to $6 per million gallons. And that would actually generate more than enough money to meet what their current request is for how much funding it would take to run the program.
Thank you. Mr. Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Todd Olson. I'm with Metro Cities. For cities to cover the fee on this, there would be basically two options. They could either pass it on to the user or they could absorb it into their existing budgets. And as Mr. Johnson alluded to, those budgets are already under strain. I understand this is only for the 11-county metro area, but we conducted a survey statewide asking cities how much they assessed of delinquent water charges. 92 cities responded. 83 had assessed unpaid water charges onto property taxes. To get to that point, they're typically 6 to 12 months delinquent before they are certified and then assessed onto the property taxes. And for statewide, of those 83 cities that responded, it was over $9.3 million in unpaid water charges. So there is already significant pressure on the city water providers' budgets.
Thank you for that information. Senator Rummel, you're starting to get a feel for the push here a little bit.
Mr. Chair, I'm not the least bit surprised, and of course we are going to work with all of these folks. I, too, just got the numbers recently, so we have a lot of work to do, but we need to meet deadline.
Mr. Clavin.
Mr. Chairman, quickly, Bruce Clavin. I represent the Irrigators Association of Minnesota today. I did talk to Senator Rumble outside the hall. Like Mr. Johnson, I just picked this up on yesterday's intros. Our board chairman is out of town, so I'm stumbling through the dark like he is. I do know that the growers have concerns with any fee increases that would come forth. Two points to make on this particular bill. I have a suspicion our growers would probably encourage you to point to the tens of millions of dollars in the Clean Water Legacy dedicated account that you'll be spending the next 24 years. Not the Lessard side, but the Clean Water side. They may encourage you to look at that first before increasing fees on them. Secondly, Mr. Olson was alluding to passing the costs on. That's something we don't have the option for on the farm. We don't raise the price of corn when we get hit with more fees. Mr. Japs handed out a sheet. I think you have this one on the back page. 22 cents per year per a person. The farm rate is $500 per year for 135-acre center pivot. Not a lot of guys live on 135 acres. They're going to have several hundred, not all of them irrigated, but even four wells, four irrigation systems, going to put you at about $2,000, and that would not be uncommon. Golf course can pass it on. Coke bottling can pass it on. Marathon can pass it on. So I encourage the members to keep that in mind forward, that we would eat the fees.
Thank you, Mr. Clavin. Others, questions, comments? Is Chris Elverum still in the room and wants to speak to this bill?
I don't care.
Mr. Chair, I believe there will be an amendment to the bill, and I think Mr. Elverum wants to speak to the amendment.
Further discussion on Senate File 3138. Senator Anderson.
Well,
I'm sorry, I missed the last thing Senator Rummel said. Was it about my amendment?
She believes you have an amendment?
I do have an amendment. And this is, I think what I'm going to propose, she has another bill that relates to the Met Council's water planning activities under the for groundwater that were partially funded in last year's Clean Water Legacy Bill, but we didn't finish the biennial work for that. And so that's the other bill that's sitting in front of you. That would be Senate File 3016. It's not on the agenda, so there's just a copy of it here. And I think there's some other pieces of that bill that would have to go to other committees, and I don't think that would help right now, but I think we should just take the appropriation section and amend it onto this bill so that the whole kit and caboodle could come to finance and we can have continued conversations with everybody who's interested in this and try to work out something to accommodate everyone. And that would be the A2 amendment that's coming around, and Mr. Knopf said there's a couple little adjustments that need to be made. But basically, this would be continued funding from the Clean Water Fund for the Met Council's groundwater protection activities.
Mr. Knopf, could you clean it up for us?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, this was actually written to another bill, but what we do is just it's just on 1.1. It moves to amend Senate File 3138, and then delete everything before as follows, and then on 1.3 be page 5, line 8, and then this would be a new section 4 on 1.4, and then delete lines 1.9 to 1.10 on the amendment. And it would just be basically putting this appropriation in to follow along with the end.
We have the amendment before us. Senator Anderson has moved the A2 amendment. Mr. Knopf has cleaned up the language for us. Any questions? Those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate the flexibility of the committee to accomplish this. This appropriation was an appropriation that we made last year, but when it went to conference committee in the second year of the biennium, it was dropped. We have had subsequent information from the Met Council that makes both me and I believe Senator Anderson believe that we should reinstate the appropriation for the second year of the biennium.
Mr. Elverum, welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself as you begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chris Elverum, manager of water supply planning with the Metropolitan Council. And yes, as Senator Rummel noted, the original request was for $938,000 for the Metropolitan Council to implement the master water supply plan for the metropolitan area. And the final bill included only $400,000 for only fiscal year 10. So this would essentially allocate the balance, $500,000, for fiscal year 11. Our planning activities were the result of legislation in 2005 that required the Met Council to develop a plan for the 7-county metro area to provide guidance for water supply development. And our efforts have included the preparation of a regional groundwater model and analysis that predicts potential issues that would arise from future demands. And it also provides guidance to those communities and options for those communities to address those issues. And so this funding would essentially continue that effort. It would provide funding to do things like geologic mapping. We're going to evaluate the effectiveness of water conservation so we can provide more tools and resources for the communities to develop those supplies in a sustainable fashion.
Members will see this. This is a finance issue, and so we have the amendment attached. Further questions, comments, Senator Anderson?
Well, Mr. Chair, sorry. I was just going to encourage members to pass the bill on to finance. And as you said, it really there's a lot of issues here about the metropolitan area fees and about the appropriations. And Senator Rummel is a member of the Finance Committee. And so I would just ask her to come to – by the time it gets to the Finance Committee, hopefully she'll have a chance to meet with all the different affected stakeholders and maybe come with a proposal that we can have broader support for. I would be hoping that's what we would see.
I'm committed to doing that.
Very good. And I would move the bill. Thank you.
Senator Dale.
Sorry, you're moving it.
Well,
Mr. Chairman, I listening to it, I'm not sure that this is all such a great idea. I wonder if we could we move it on without a recommendation to the next committee?
Sure.
I'd like to add that. I'd like to move that we Well, Senator Chaudhary has already made his motion. Do I have to amend that?
I'll withdraw the motion.
Senator Chaudhary withdraws his motion. Senator Dill, the motion's yours.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we see.
I can give you some direction, Senator Dill?
3138.
Okay, then 3138 be moved on to the Finance Committee without recommendation.
Senator Dill moves that Senate File 3138 as amended be moved to Finance without recommendation. Discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed, motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Rummel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
Senator Chaudhary, do we have to reschedule for Thursday these last three?
Let's start, Senator Torres Ray.
Senator Torres Ray, members, if you'll hang in there.
Okay.
Senate File 2593. We're apparently getting close to a deadline of some kind.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, members. I really appreciate that you're giving me a few minutes. We're going to be as brief as we possibly can. I do have to go to another policy committee, so I have to meet deadlines, so I really appreciate this opportunity. And Mr. Chair and members, Senate File 2593 relates to environment requiring public buildings to use environmentally sensitive cleaning products. Mr. Chairman and members, I am excited to be here to have this opportunity to talk to you about this bill because I believe that we have an opportunity to change a trend that is quite alarming. We actually know today that each year more than 6.2 billion pounds of chemicals are used by the cleaning industry. The cleaning products that I am talking about today are cleaning products that are being used in public buildings, and we actually pay for that. And what is happening is that we also are being asked to pay for cleaning wastewater that contains these products. So we pay twice. We pay for the product, and then we pay for cleaning the wastewaters that contain this product. So what I am proposing to you today, and Senator, I am, Mr. Chair and Senators, I am working on trying to put together some numbers behind this just to kind of show you how much money we spend in purchasing these products and then how much money we spend cleaning up the chemicals from these products from our waters. So there are a few things that have happened before I got here, Mr. Chairman and members. I want you to know that we've talked to many people about this, and we would like to point to a concern that cities have today. We have been told that this is expensive, that cities cannot afford to do that, that school districts are going to have to spend a lot of money. So we have a stipulation in this bill in page 3, and this is in section in subdivision 3F, that it simply says that if this is not economically feasible, they just don't have to do it. And this is, again, this is an effort to encourage best practices. We just want to move people in this direction. We want to encourage them to use these products. If they cannot afford to, and there is a lot of speculation as to how much more expensive these products are, the reality is that the industry is moving in a direction that is much more economically feasible for us, and so we want to encourage the use of these products, and we want the cities and the school districts to really explore the use of these products because we are moving in a direction where we can really afford to do this.
So, Senator Torres Ray, this bill has passed the Health Committee.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
So they determine whether this is good health policy. Today we are trying to figure out whether it's good environmental policy.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
This needs to go to the State and Local Government Committee, and they need to figure out if it's good state and local government policy, and that's for them to discuss. And I think the Education Committee wants to figure out if this is good policy for school buildings, too. So, and we have you need to meet a deadline. We don't have time for full-blown testimony. You've had the parties know what the arguments are. Why don't we assume for brevity's sake that the witnesses you have at the table support this bill and are available to answer questions, particular questions. Mr. Johnson, do you have anything on the environmental policy of this? Other than, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, I also forgot to I neglected to move an amendment that PCA has recommended that we do, and it's relevant to this committee. So, with your permission, I would like to move that.
Well, why don't we take the testimony from Mr. Johnson, and we'll figure out what the situation is with your amendment. Is it an oral amendment, Senator Torres Ray?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm just deleting a piece.
Okay. Mr. Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Craig Johnson. I represent the League of Minnesota Cities. We have significant concerns along with the Association of Minnesota Counties and the Minnesota School Board Association with some of the implications of this bill. The environmental sections I can be pretty specific with. And what it really comes down to, for members who do not know, is that 2 years ago, local units of government were given access to the state purchase contract. We already have that on a voluntary basis if we find it to be cost-effective to use that. If you go to find cleaning products through the state purchase contract system, all of those products are ones that meet the requirements required by this bill. So any community or school that chooses to use that system right now would have access to those and only those products through that system. The challenge is doing that and mandating it on all levels of government and all sizes and locations of cities. Small purchases do not always make sense and may cost significantly more through the state's purchasing system because of shipping costs. You also have the access to those through the state's website, and Mr. Chair, I can happily show this to the committee. It is environmental in nature. The links to both Minnesota's environmentally preferred goods and services through the Department of Admin website and the MPCA website, and the product experience case studies that give you information about which products to use do not get you either a list of the products you should be using or to the state purchase contract system to make those purchases. In fact, one sends you to a December 2000 spreadsheet that simply says that the state once purchased $300,000 of cleaning products, and the other one sends you to a dead link that is to an office that no longer exists within state government. If you ask for further information through contact, you get that office's address and phone number, which is no longer connected. This is not something that we need a new mandate to get a good environmental product out to the public on. We need a better system between the Pollution Control Agency and the Department of Administration to inform local units of government about what products are best and where they can save money and help the health of the public if they choose to do that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Torres Ray, your oral amendment, and then you can have the last word.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate it. We have been having conversations, the people who are
Senator
working
Torres-Ray,
with me.
What's your oral amendment?
The oral amendment is from PCA to the lead C on section subdivision 3.
So that would be to line, delete lines 2.20 to 2.24?
Mm-hmm. That's correct, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, Senator Anderson, would you like to make that?
Sure, I'll
motion.
Move that.
On the motion, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. Final thoughts, Senator Torres Ray.
Mr. Chairman and members, I guess actually Mr. Johnson actually helped me make the case for why we need to move in this direction. That's precisely the issue here. Who actually has the responsibility to move us in this direction? What we're doing today is not sustainable, Mr. Chairman and members, and you know this. We need to begin to use these products. These products need to be known. We need to, the agencies that are responsible for making sure that we know about the availability of these products need to work on it. They need to make them available so that governments can make responsible decisions. The assumption and what we know here, Mr. Chairman, is that in the long term we will save money because they will not be coming to us to ask for funding to clean up wastewater. So the intent here is to move it to move us into environmentally sound practices that will actually help us save money in the long term.
Senator Dill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, members, I intend to vote against this bill, but I assume it's going to pass anyway, so I'm going to make a motion that we recommend that Senate Bill 2593 be passed on to the, is it the Health Committee or the
State and Local Government.
State and Local Government without recommendation. And I'll be voting against this amendment or this up motion.
Okay. You've Senator Dill moves that Senate file 2593 as amended pass without recommendation and be re-referred to the Committee on State and Local Government.
Mr. Chair, I would speak against Senator Dill's motion just because I think as the Environmental Policy Committee, some of the concerns that were raised by the opponents were more related to the administration of the bill or how this would be implemented. But on the overall environmental impact, there's no doubt that moving towards a system of less toxic chemicals in Minnesota is a good one. And so I would just speak against Senator Dill's motion and hope that we would pass it with recommendation.
All those in favor of Senator Dill's motion, please say aye.
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 Opposed?
No.
The motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank
and,
you, Senator.
And we will take Senator Metzen's bill. Members, we're meeting tomorrow morning at 9.
I don't know.
So we'll take the other bills on today's agenda at that time. However, until then, we are in recess until 5 p.m., and we will be meeting in room G15. And I'd ask that members please be on time. If you would like, we can order dinner for the committee. I'll be happy to spring for pizza.
Ooh!
So let us know so we can take care of that. But it's very important that we begin on time at 5.
I'm late for a meeting.
Meeting's in recess.